Storytelling awakens us to that which is real, honest. It is the most pure form of communication because it transcends the individual. The Kalahari Bushmen have said, a story is like the wind. It comes from a far-off place and we feel it. Those things that are most personal are most general and are in turn most trusted. Stories bind. They are connective tissues. They are basic to who we are. A story has a composite personality which grows out of its community. It maintains a stability within that community, providing common knowledge as to how things are, how things should be, knowledge based in experience. These stories become the conscience of the group. They belong to everyone. But what about earth and story? Simon Ortiz, the Pueblo poet, says, in continuance of the stories and songs, the earth shall continue.
But we forget, we human people, and our elders have told us that our job is to remember, and that's where the stories come in. Now this summer, just a few miles up the Hudson from here, I sat watching the sunrise over the river next to a flotilla of nearly 200 canoes and kayaks that were beached for the night. And as I watched the light come over the water, a head poked up and moved directly toward me. When she hit the shallows, her shell rose out of the water and she came toward me on powerful legs and looked me right in the eye as if she wanted to ask me something. And why not? She and I, we go back a long time to a story we both remember, part of the creation story told by the first peoples of this place. In the beginning, there was the sky world, where people lived alongside the great tree of life on whose branches grew all the seeds, medicines, fruits, all the gifts of the plants on a single tree. But one day a great wind came along and felled the tree, and a hole opened where the roots had been. And a beautiful young woman, called in our language Gishkokwe, the sky woman, when she ventured to the edge to look down, she lost her footing. And then when she reached to break her fall, she grabbed a branch from the tree of life. And she fell like a maple seed, pirouetting on an autumn breeze. A column of light streamed from the hole in the sky world, marking her path where only darkness had been before. But in that emptiness, there were many. They saw there a small object, a mere dust mote in the beam. And as it grew closer, they could see that it was a woman, arms outstretched, her long black hair billowing behind her as she spiraled toward them. And the geese all nodded at one another. They rose as one from the water in a wave of goose music. And she felt the beat of their wings as they flew beneath and broke her fall. Far from the only home she had ever known, she caught her breath at the embrace of feathers. And so it began. From the beginning of time, we are told that the very first encounter between humans and other beings of the earth was marked by care, by responsibility, borne on the strong wings of geese. And the world at that time was covered entirely by water. And of course, the geese could not hold the woman forever. So they called a council of all of the beings to decide what to do. And as Turtle floated in the water gathering, he offered to let her rest upon his back. And the others understood that she needed land. The deep divers among them had heard of mud down at the bottom of the water. They agreed to go get some. And one by one, the animals offered their help. The otter, the loon, the sturgeon, the beaver. But the depth, the darkness, And the pressures were too great even for these strongest of swimmers, who came up gasping and their heads ringing, until only the little muskrat was left, the weakest diver of all. And he volunteered to go, while the others looked on doubtfully. His small legs flailed as he worked his way downward. He was gone a very long time. They waited and waited, fearing the worst for their relative, until a stream of bubbles arose and the small, limp body of the muskrat floated upward. But the others noticed that in his paw was tightly clenched, and when they opened his paw, there was a small handful of mud. And Turtle said, "Here, spread this mud across my back, and I will hold it for her." And Sky Woman did as Turtle asked, and then she began to sing. She sang a song of gratitude, and then she began to dance in a circle around the back of the turtle. As her feet caressed the earth, the land grew and grew from that mud on Turtle's back. And then from the branch in her hand, she seeded the earth with green. And so the earth was made, not by one alone, but from the alchemy of two essential elements, gratitude and reciprocity. Together they formed what we know today as Turtle Island. In this creation story, the earth is made of gifts and gratitude, and perhaps that is what the earth continues to ask of us today, gratitude for all that we have been given. Now, gratitude may seem like weak tea, given the desperate challenges that lie before us, but it is powerful medicine, more than a simple thank you. Gratitude pulls us into relationship with other entities, reminding us that our very existence relies on the gifts of others. Gratitude calls us to acknowledge the personhood of all beings, from maple trees to snapping turtles. And gratitude is humbling. It's an antidote to the arrogance of our time. It reminds us that we are just one member of the democracy of species. It reminds us that the earth does not belong to us. Indigenous story traditions are full of cautionary tales about the failure of gratitude. When people forget to honor the gift, the consequences are always material as well as spiritual. The spring dries up, the corn doesn't grow, the animals do not return to those who have neglected gratitude. But the Western storytelling tradition is strangely silent on this matter. And so we find ourselves in an era where we are rightly afraid of the climate that we have created. The next step in our cultural evolution, if we are to persist as a species on this generous planet, is to take to heart Sky Woman's first lesson and be living expressions of gratitude to the earth.
Landscape shapes culture. Aldo Leopold states, "The rich diversity of the world's cultures reflects a corresponding diversity in the wilds that gave them birth." Perhaps we can begin to find the origins of our cultural inheritance in the land. Not to move backwards, but forward to understanding the profound interconnectedness of all living things. As Gregory Bateson says, "If the world be connected, then thinking in terms of stories must be shared by all mind or minds, whether ours or those of redwood forests and sea anemones." There is no such thing as waste, except in the world of man. The concentric circles which bind a healthy habitat include vulnerable and venerable species. It is a familiar scenario, predator and prey, as though a shaft of light falls in the forgotten corner of an attic and a precious possession is retrieved. We too are predators. A primal memory is struck like a match. I hold on to a rope between two poles. I grip with both hands the life I live and the one I have forgotten. When in the presence of natural order, we remember a potentiality of life which has been overgrown by civilization. Thank you. To ask a question and find a story about an episode of Earth is to remember who we are. Wild rivers run through our veins.
Now, each summer, I teach at a remote wilderness field station up in the Adirondacks, in a community of about 100 scientists and students, where it's abundantly clear that the land and other species are our source of knowledge. We may think we're learning about them, but in fact, we are learning from them. And one of our very best teachers returns every summer, just after the summer solstice, clambering her way up a steep bluff from the lake, under cover of darkness, to lay her eggs in the warm, open sand of our volleyball court. With powerful bear-like paws, she flings the sand aside, digging furiously. Her sharp, snouted mouth open, she gasps for breath, rests for a minute, and digs some more with fierce maternal commitment and utter disregard for the students who surround her, snapping photos as eggs like leathery ping-pong balls leave her body. When she has covered them all back safely, she entrusts them to the earth and makes her way back to the water. And as predictable as the solstice, she comes every year. We know her by the little notch marked at the edge of her shell. Now, there is a lot of sand on our lake, hundreds of good places for a snapping turtle nest. But for some reason, this one chooses to bring her offspring to us. Our students are thrilled, of course, to be witnesses. It's a highlight of their field biology summer. But they also want to play volleyball. So the herpetology class carefully unearths the eggs and, with loving care, take the eggs to another site that they have prepared and measured to be sure it's a good place to incubate. It's full of warm sand, safe from predators, so that the snappers will hatch. Now this year, on the very next day, there was another mother in just the same spot. And that had never happened before. The next day, there was another. And another. One day there were two, one of them basking right on the welcome mat of camp headquarters. In all, more than a dozen snapping turtles came among us in as many days. It was a deluge of turtles. And as scientists, we are asking why. Why did all these turtles come to us in unprecedented numbers? And when our students went to find suitable transplant sites for the repeated batches of new eggs, they found one answer. The usual sand spits were underwater. Students wandered around with thermometers trying in vain to find good places. The exposed sandy banks, which were usually dry and warm, were now cold and wet. Unusually heavy rains this year had flooded the usual nest sites, and as the lake level rose, they had to seek out higher ground. The snapping turtles and their children had become climate refugees. But here's the thing that haunts me. There are a lot of sandy places on our lake. Why our wholly artificial rectangle of sand? Why would reclusive, solitary beings struggle up a rocky bluff and walk into a community of 100 scientists? Why did they come to us to do their most important thing? Not hidden, not covert, but as if demanding to be the center of attention. And shouldn't we be paying attention when the turtles head for high ground and wander among us in a kind of desperation when at their most vulnerable they come to us? There are many ways to ask why and many ways to answer. Science, as one way of knowing, armed with models to predict the coming changes and thermometers to seek out refuges, is a powerful tool for addressing climate change, but not the only one. which is why a scientist stands here before you, yes, listening to the indisputable data, and yes, listening to a message carried by snapping turtles. The ones who carry the earth upon their back, walking into our midst with a message that we reach to understand. I think the earth asks more of us than gratitude. The earth asks that we give our gifts in return so that the world can continue. This is the message carried by those turtles. They're asking us to remember that covenant of reciprocity. They're asking us to honor an agreement that at the beginning of the world, they were our life raft. So much closer to the end, we must be theirs. Turtles among us. How do we respond to the urgency when we sit at a tipping point on climate, when our plant and animal relatives are disappearing? It can no longer be business as usual. It's no longer a matter of small acts of stewardship, not enough to tenderly move eggs from one place to another when there are no more places for them to go. It's not enough to write praise songs for turtles, not enough to study the hormones that turn all the eggs to males when the temperature rises, not enough to write a regulation to manage lake levels. The earth asks us to use our considerable gifts in return for all that we have taken. We need a movement made of equal parts of outrage and compassion. We need voices raised in a mighty shout on behalf of Turtle Island.
The ability to bear what you see, to say what you see, to stand up for what you see, to speak about what you see. All these things are related. Without the ability to bear what you see or hear or sense, nothing can ever change.
Let the cards fall as they may, they say. Must we? Must we witness and watch and do nothing as road cuts, clear cuts, the cut bodies of coyote, mountain lion, and deer are strung up by their hind legs as a warning to others they are not welcome? Must we witness and watch and do nothing as the peeled bodies of elders named Douglas fir, cedar, and larch are chained to the flatbeds of trucks and hauled away on our highways, highways littered with roadkills, roadkills paving the way to dams, dammed rivers, the Colorado, the Columbia, the Snake, and Mississippi, dammed canyons, Glen Canyon, Davis Gulch, Cathedral in the Desert? Speak their names, remember their names. These places of beauty, these places of origin, toxic, toxic wastes, toxic deserts, bombed, battered, and betrayed in the name of national security. Speak their names, remember their names. The Nevada test site in the Mojave, Hanford on the banks of the Columbia, Rocky Flats, Alamogordo, Dugway, the floodplains of eastern Idaho. The nuclear waste is shimmering, simmering. Coyote watches with burning eyes, Bosch's owl with burning eyes in paradise. This is the natural history of the dead. There is a war raging in our own nation, and it is not civil. Speak their names, remember their names. They are going, going. The salmon, grizzly, tortoise, tiger beetle, bobcat, and lynx, marbled murrelet, red-spotted frog, they are disappearing before our own eyes, find their eyes, burning eyes. We are slowly committing suicide. This is the natural history of the dead. The land is being stripped, strip mined, strip searched. Let the cards fall where they may, they say.
Some see a feather and think it frail. But the feathered ones arrived as souls with only hollow quills and eiderdown. And they were the ones who saw the stars of both hemispheres before human beings ever could. So the ones with the little frail feathers discovered the new worlds first and left them unharmed. and crossed oceans before humans dared. Saw unending aerial views of earth and sky, while mere humans had to wait for centuries to fledge satellites into the air that could see for them. There are those souls born into this earth to bear 25,000 feathers over a lifetime. These winged ones climb the wind, and they can cover 2,500 miles in a single migration. These souls, so small and yet so great, carry the overview and the ground view, all from flying until exhausted, then resting, feasting, homing, birthing, and finally up again and away, through the storm, through sunlight, through the wonder and the danger and the hunger for it all. Some look at this winged creature and see only a swath of painted feathers. But these souls were born into the earth, explicitly created to fly through more than one world and to return, ever return to tell the stories of what can be seen when one is allowed to soar.
Once upon a time, the skies over the Potawatomi homelands carried flocks of birds so vast they darkened the sky. They could take days to pass by overhead. Flocks so large that their collective weight when roosting broke off the limbs of trees. And I was surprised to find that while I knew a fair bit about the extinction of the passenger pigeon, I knew relatively little of their lives, so I started reading. I read about their communal nesting, all wing to wing, the way they cherished their single egg, how they shaped the forest with their feasting on oaks, and how they came like a distant wind and settled by the thousands to roost, conversing with one another, mothers, children, relatives of all kinds. In the voices which linger in the name that our people bestowed upon them, we call them O Mimi. I was also fascinated to learn about how the lives of O Mimi intersected with the lives of my Potawatomi ancestors, how many of our people understood the great flocks as flocks of departed souls, and how today we wear bird clan regalia of red and blue in their honor. And that one of the early chroniclers of the abundance of O Mimi was none other than Simon Pokagan, a Potawatomi leader who described them as it was proverbial among our fathers that if the Great Spirit in his wisdom could have created a more elegant bird in plumage, form, and movement, he never did. And among Simon Pokagan's people up there on the St. Joseph River was a leader named Shishagan, who had a daughter named Shanoda, the wind blowing through, and she was my great, great, many greats grandmother. Like O Mimi, they moved about the landscape together too, making their lives in the oak forest, where they too feasted on acorns, set their lodges in communal circles, and relatives of all kinds, wing to wing, cherishing their single offspring. And they gathered around the fire at night to tell stories. But someone else wanted those forests for farms, and the birds became a threat to the crops. And so in 1838, a year in which passenger pigeons were killed by the thousands in traps, in shotguns and nests, packed in salt and sent by trainloads back to the east, the birds became fewer, and so our people became fewer. Our Potawatomi people were canoe people. Our lodges were built on cold blue lakes under the birches and the pines. lakes that rang with the voices of loons. Our Potawatomi people were canoe people until they made us walk, until someone else wanted that forest, and we were marched away at gunpoint from all that we knew. Marched from Michigan to Kansas on what became known as the Trail of Death. And I imagine my grandma Shaw Noda's hand just trailing over her beloved medicine plants as she walked away from them, saying a silent farewell to maples. We should ask them about climate change. In a single season, they lived it. What is it like to exchange a cool, lush forest for a hot, dusty grassland? Lakes for dry riverbeds, baskets of wild rice for sacks of weevily flour, loons for, well, there is no replacement for loons. Something so beautiful, so ancient, so prolific, simply vanish. What happened to the sound of their wings? Where did everybody go? What happened to the world I knew? And you know what? Every time I looked at that photograph, I felt my great-grandmother's voice tugging at my sleeve. Born on the shores of Lake Michigan and buried on the Kansas prairie, she probably said it too. How could something so beautiful, so ancient, so prolific, just go away? What happened to the world I used to know? And climate change is a major driver of species extinction. On average, we lose 200 species every day. Every day. Shouldn't we be looking over our shoulder and saying goodbye as well? Because the stories of our people and the story of Omimi converge, for both were swept away by the same wind. And we know what happens when two winds, two weather fronts collide. Great turbulence and often suffering for the ones below. And two winds, two worldviews met on this continent. Worldviews which color our relations with the living land, which shape our answer to the question of, what does land mean? You can't understand the things just with your mind, because as human people, we have our minds, we have emotion, we have body, we have spirit. And if you understand something with only one of those, you understand it incompletely. Whereas the scientific ways of knowing very intentionally privileges the intellect, not because those other things don't exist, but because that's the epistemology of science. So what I think is so can be so powerful is when you bring these ways of knowing together, learning from the land, all of those ways come together. And then we have a way of thinking that moves people, not just informs them.